Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. Good afternoon, folks. Welcome back once again to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, the Tanakh edition. And, of course, as you hopefully know, this is the place where we talk about exactly those portions of the Torah that don't get as much discussion because they're not part of the regular Torah cycle or the Haftorahs. We've already gone through in years past some of the other books, like most of the apostolic writings and so forth. What we started into quite a while back now was the histories of the land of, well, both northern and southern kingdoms, a.k.a. Israel or Judea. And at this point, we are in the time frame of one of the most infamous kings of all, and that would be King Ahab and his gnarly wife, Jezebel, certainly the prototypes for a lot of people that we still see hanging around, sadly. So, anyway, last week we finished chapter 18 talking about one of my favorite stories and one of my the most colorful prophets, I guess is the way I would put it, in Scripture, Eliyahu, and in particular the story of the priests of Baal and how it was that he basically put them to shame and accomplished what it was he was called to do, which leads us to this week. But before we do have Rob Miller back with us, and we're thankful for that. So let me just ask Rob, hey, Rob, since you weren't with us last week, anything in that particular portion that you want to just make sure we recap or don't forget as we move on?
Well, one thing as we look at this condition of Israel, it just keeps declining from the original faith, the faith of Yahweh.
Right.
Which is unlike any other faith on this planet, even today. It's without representation of idol, edifice, or icon. Yet here in Israel, we see all of those things being utilized for worship. Now, Ahab, or Ahab, fell completely under the influence of his queen, Jezebel, the heathen princess, daughter of Eight Baal, the king of Sidon. Fierce, ambitious, revengeful, Jezebel easily established her dominion in the kingdom of Israel. She was a fanatical worshiper, an evangelical worshiper of Baal, and strove hard to spread this idol worship in Israel. All over the land, she consecrated high places and built altars upon which countless sacrifices were offered to the idols. No less than 450 prophets of Baal were in the capital, and 400 prophets of Astarte sat at her table, at her court. At the same time, she persecuted the true Hebrew prophets so fiercely that not one prophet would raise their voice without forfeiting his life. And as for Ahab, he was quite content to let the heathen queen rule his country. Like his predecessors, he was not averse to idol worship. The worship of the calves in Bethel and Dan went on with unabated zeal and all sorts of abominable practices common in Phoenicia were willingly emulated. So this is the condition, and it all comes to a head at the showdown at Mount Carmel. There, Queen Isabel, or Jezebel, has amassed all of her spiritual prowess, the 850 prophets. And they're all there to show once and for all who the true Elohim of Israel will be. Will it be Baal Markart with his consort Astarte? Or will it be Yahweh with no one besides him? They were now gathered at Mount Carmel together with the great masses of the Israelite people. A representation of all of the tribes that were there. The chieftains were there. King Ahab was there too, to witness who would win. There's never been a contest like this before. Never had there been so pronounced light against darkness, right against wrong, true against false. And at this mountain, and at that time, everything came together. Heaven and hell were at odds. And so here we see a showdown. And not since the war, the heavenly war against the forces of darkness and the forces of heaven, had there ever been a showdown like this. So this was a rematch, if you will. Now, Elijah's there, and he has full confidence in Yahweh. Now, it's interesting how the proceedings go along, because he's angry. We can tell by his language he's angry. He's angry that Israel has brought it to this, that Ahab has brought it to this, that someone hasn't spoken up before, and it's all resting on his shoulders. There's nobody there beside him that is taking his side. The prophets of Baal have each other. They have a support group. They have the queen. They have the king. And all the people seem to be in their court. So popularity is with them. And Elijah's alone with his Elohim, Yahweh, creator of the universe. So Elijah calls to the people to come closer and watch. He wants this documented. And he gathers 12 stones, one for each of the tribes of Israel. And he erects an altar to Yahweh, and he ordered that a trench be dug around the altar and filled with water. And he poured water upon the sacrifice and upon the wood until it was drenched. And then he uttered a short prayer. Hear me, Yahweh, hear me. So that this people may know that you, Yahweh, are Elohim, and that you are turning their hearts back to you, that you are causing teshuva. Then the fire of Yahweh fell, and it consumed the burnt offering, the wood, the stone, the dust. It licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, Yahweh is Elohim. Yahweh is Elohim. And Eliyahu said to the prophets, said to the people, seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let one of them escape. And they seized them and brought them down to the Wadi Kishon, and they killed them there. Now, it's been argued that this was not what Yahweh wanted, that he gave no such order for the extermination of the prophets of Baal and Astarte. There is no order, except that in the Torah.
I was going to say, except for the fact that he's pretty consistent about it.
Yeah. In the Torah, it says that you shall not let an idolater live. An unrepentant idolater live. You can't, and essentially a false priest, a false prophet. And these are all guilty of the above. And so he has the mandate in the Torah to kill them.
Correct.
So he doesn't need a direct command from Yahweh. Yahweh's already stated what he
He's got it.
Wants.
How he's already had a direct command to do it.
Right. And so we can see, and this is why, by the way, at Yom Kippur, that we say the same words that the children of Israel said at Mount Carmel. Yahweh is Elohim, Yahweh is Elohim, seven times during the liturgy of the of Yom Kippur, as if to atone for our ancestors' doubt before the showdown. So, anyways, it's no wonder that Elijah is the one that is selected of all the prophets before to lead in the great tribulation times the children of Israel again to safety and to have a showdown again, this time with the forces of the Mashiach Nagid, the negative Messiah, and the forces of light. And again, according to scripture, he'll win. He'll be on the winning side. So all of this is a an amazing turn of events. It should have, even to this day, it should ring out, and the ripple effect should still be with us, that we don't need any more proof. We shouldn't have needed any proof at all, but we certainly don't need any more proof that there is no Elohim but Yahweh. And it would cause us, it should cause us to worship differently, worship with trepidation, that we do not add to or take away from the pure worship of Yahweh. And I think, and let me say, there is a, and I've said it before, but it bears saying again, there's something in man that finds idolatry attractive. There's something in man that longs to create a God in his image.
It's personal power, I think.
I think so. Right across the street from me is a store that sells idols and paraphernalia to go with it. And I have to walk past there. And it's an amazing feeling. You certainly, you don't have that in America. You don't have a store of gods.
Well, you know, you could argue differently depending upon which gods you're talking about. I mean,
sure,
there certainly are all kinds of replacements for them that qualify as gods of one kind or another. We've talked about all kinds of examples there. I'm thinking about a cell phone store anymore.
but that's not blatant. That's not that's selling cell phones, selling communication devices that one may idolize. This store exists purely
to sell idols.
Sell idols and fetishes.
I remember seeing them when I was in Thailand.
And the it's beautiful. They're all red and gold. You know, the trappings are all in red and gold. And the smell is of jasmine. So when I walk past there, you smell the smell and you think, oh, that's a beautiful smell.
It is.
You see the red and gold and you say, that's beautiful. There's something, again, in man that finds red and gold extremely attractive. And that's the colors of the temple.
it's the colors of French, Italian furniture, too.
yeah. So anyway, what I'm saying is that it turns the head. And there's something that I have to willingly make a stand of not looking into the store. And and enjoying the view. There's the only thing that comes close to that is when an attractive woman walks by and you find yourself looking almost subconsciously and admiring. So there's something in idolatry that is attractive to man. So when Yahweh said, "Don't worship me like them," so he didn't just say, "Don't commit idolatry." He said, "Don't treat me like an idol. Don't worship me in their way."
The way they do, right. Exactly.
The way they do. Don't use their practices on me. Which is interesting, because if you take Christianity, I'm just picking on Christianity right now. Take Christianity, and what they've done over 1700 years is they have absorbed every practice, every pagan practice.
Forbidden pagan practice, as a matter of fact, yeah.
Yes, and they've incorporated it. When you take the representation of a god, an idol, they've incorporated idol worship into the church. When you take the demagogues of idolatry, the lesser gods, you have one main god, and then you have the lesser gods, the demagogues. They have done that by taking the Trinity as the main godhead. And then you have the court of saints that are prayed to as intermediaries of the one Godhead. And that's very troublesome, because that's against Torah. Now,
correct.
You have to, now here's the thing. In the New Testament, if you call it the New Testament and you make a demarcation between Old Testament and New Testament. In the New Testament, you don't find an elucidation of the Torah. You just find a quick summary of the Ten Commandments that the Messiah gave.
I'm not sure what you're driving at with that.
Okay. What I'm saying is that there is no letter by letter statement in the Torah. I mean, in the New Testament. It's all in the Torah. What the New Testament, or what the Nazarene writings do, is stand on the Torah. If you take the Torah away, then you don't have a law to the New Testament. You have the New Testament, or the Nazarene writings, pointing to the Torah. The Torah is the foundation. If you don't have the foundation, then everything falls. Or, in this case, everything's liquid. You can interpret it any way you want to. And it's done that way.
Right.
The supreme law is not anymore, you shall have no other Elohim besides me. That's the supreme law. Number one law. Yeshua said that. But in the church, the number one law is God is love. Now, why is that different? Because in the Torah, we serve Yahweh. In the Christian theology, God serves man. In the Torah, you shall have no other love besides Yahweh. In Christianity, God loves everyone. The sinner, the saint, equally. You'll hear them say that. And in the Torah, God hates sin, God hates his enemies, and will ultimately kill his enemies. In Christian theology, God loves everybody, and in its purest sense, universalism, God's not going to kill anybody. In Catholicism, he doesn't kill everybody. What's he do? He puts them in purgatory and lets them buy themselves out. And so it's an interesting difference. And it's just like the prophets of Baal on that mountain. Every child of Yahweh has that same showdown in his heart. And he has to choose. Will he follow the Elohim of the Torah? Or will he follow the Baal of Christianity? And it's just that simple.
Absolutely right.
It's just that simple. And I know it's offensive. I know that someone hearing today that counts themselves as a Christian will find it offensive to consider that the Elohim of Christian theology, of Neoplatonism, is not Yahweh. Just like in Islam, the supreme deity is not Yahweh, it's Allah. It's not Yahweh in Christianity, it's this God. The same deity in Isaiah 11:65, where it says that they have forsaken Yahweh and they've turned to God and to his consort, Mene. And what did they do? They love to make their drink offerings and their bread offerings. Same thing that Christianity does. It's the only thing that they still hold on to is this bread and wine. Why? Because it was part of the worship of Baal. And so it's what you do with it that makes it important. Okay. And we want to make sure there's a demarcation, and that's what I'm really getting at, is that you have to make a decision. Will you follow Yahweh or will you follow Baal? Will you do the practices of the pagans or will you follow the Torah, the express word of Yahweh?
And that, of course, was precisely the question that Eliyahu asked and that was answered by fire in the last section that we're recapping here.
Well, I would argue that it was answered by fire again in Acts 2.
Oh, yes. How many times we got to keep asking the same question, expecting a different answer, I guess is what you could say. You're right.
Well, exactly. And you know, what does Yeshua say? He says, you know, I'm bringing a fire, and I wished it was kindled now. And the fire that he's talking about is the fire of judgment. And it's going to get ugly. And so with his second coming, that's when the fire actually gets ignited. He wanted it. He said in his heart, he said, I wish everything was going to happen in this first advent. And he wasn't sure that it wasn't. But by the end of his ministry on earth, he realized that there would be a second advent. And so he longed for the purification fires, the refiner fire that would be ignited upon this earth to finally, once and for all, burn out this cancer of paganism. And there would be only the pure worship of Yahweh like it was in the Garden of Eden.
And as it stands right now, we're still waiting on that. And obviously, we've got a ways to go based on a number of other things that we're seeing.
Yes.
All right. Well, very good, Rob. Thanks for the recap. What we'll do when we get back, folks, is we will continue the story of Eliyahu. And to some extent, and this is kind of the way I'll introduce it as we go to the music, there's a little bit of an anti-climax, if you will, here, because it seems like what Elijah came to do has been accomplished. And now we're going to see a whole different kind of an attitude on his part and with respect to what's going on in the rest of the northern and southern kingdoms as well, too. So we'll pick it up there when we get back with chapter 19 of the book of 1 Kings.
Just say that. Do-do-do-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Keepin' Torah's a joy.
Welcome back now, folks, to the second half of the first hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition. And at this point, we are having finished a bit of a recap as well as some, explanation of modern paganism and why it is that the battles that Eliyahu was expressing and laying down for all time are still being fought. Anyway, we head into chapter 19. Let me just read the first couple of verses here, and then we'll go to MP for some commentary. And it says, Ahab, the king here, told Jezebel, his wicked wife, everything that Eliyahu had done, and all about his killing all the prophets by the sword. And let's see, it's usually by the mouth of the sword. Of the sword. And all about his killing all the prophets. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Eliyahu saying, so may the gods do, and may they do more so, for by this time tomorrow, I will make your soul like the soul of one of them. In other words, I'm going to kill you all. And the commentary I'm looking at notes that word kol or all appears no less than three times in this one verse. So let's pause there, Mark. I didn't read the first three. That's just first two. But there's a lot in the next couple that we'll come back to. Go ahead. Mark and Pete?
Sorry, I had my mic shut off. Okay, here we go.
Okay, had me concerned there.
Okay, on July 30th of 2016, I taught on a triennial Torah portion from Bereishit 20. Avraham's last bout with sight walking. Okay, Eliyahu was about to do the same and react to the human power that he could see that instant instead of trusting Yehovah's power that he just witnessed. Now, what we perceive has a very powerful influence over us, sometimes even greater than what we know to be the truth. In verse 1, Ahav filled Jezebel in on Eliyahu's amazing Elohim's answering Eliyahu by fire and burning up the offering and all the water, and also about the people of Eliyahu killing all of the prophets of Baal with the sword. I think it's safe to say that Jezebel was not pleased. She worshipped Ashtaroth. She may have thought, was Eliyahu in town to do the same to the priests and priestesses of the groves? Because she must have seen him, and possibly Ahab had told her about it because he saw him at the gate when he drove through in his chariot. Zamar has this on verses 1 and 2. It says, with the rout of the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, Eliyahu had brought about a tremendous Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name. Even Ahav was impressed, but the implacable Jezebel was unshaken and intended to use repressive terror to undo the results of Eliyahu's feat, swearing by her gods to kill him, verse 2. So in verse 2, back to my notes, she sent a messenger, a malach, in other places translated angel, to Eliyahu to put the fear of Jezebel in him. So her threat sounded a lot like Ben-Hadad's to Ahav in chapter 20, where Ben-Hadad says, and Ben-Hadad sent to him and said, the gods do so unto me and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for hands full for all the people that follow me. Okay, so very much the same thing, and you'll see this a lot in the scripture. She did not specify Ashtoreth, but called on the pantheon of pagan heathen gods. She seems to think that calling on a vast multitude of deities will swell Eliyahu. And her plan seemed to work. By the way, it looks to me as if Jezebel may have prophesied her own demise. Notice in verse 3 that Eliyahu saw, I assume in his spirit, and his sight drove him as far as he could go in the land without leaving it, Beersheba. What was it that he saw? Do you think that maybe he saw the demonic host of false gods that Jezebel called against him? Could it be that Jehovah used a similar vision in 2 Kings to show another prophet's servant that they were not alone? And that is seen in 2 Kings chapter 6 and verses 14 to 17, where it says, therefore sent he Hadad, Israel's king, Syria's king rather, thither horses and chariots and great host. And they came by night and compassed the city about. And when the servant of the man of Elohim was risen early and gone forth, behold, the host compassed the city both with horses and with chariots. And his servant said unto him, alas, my master, how shall we do? And he answered, fear not, for they that are with us are more than they that are with them. And Elisha prayed and said, Jehovah, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. And Jehovah opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Now, the two episodes, I think, are linked. Eliyahu failed the test, in my opinion, and ran as far as he could. His Talmid, by the time of 2 Kings 6, Elisha had received a double portion of Eliyahu's Ruach. And we see that in 2 Kings 2, verses 8 through 15. 9 through 15, where it says, and it came to pass when they had gone over, that Eliyahu said unto Elisha, ask what I shall do unto thee before I be taken away from thee. And Elisha said, I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. And he said, thou hast asked a hard thing. If thou see me taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee. And if not, it shall not be. And it came to pass, as they went on and talked, that behold, a chariot of fire and horses of fire parted them both asunder, and Eliyahu went up by the whirlwind into heaven, and Elisha saw, and he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. And he saw him no more, and he took hold of his own clothes and rent them in two pieces. He took up also the mantle of Eliyahu that fell from him and went back and stood by the bank of the Yarden. And he took the mantle of Eliyahu that fell from him and smote the waters and said, where is Jehovah Elohim of Eliyahu? And when he had smitten the waters, they parted hither and thither, and Elisha went over. And when the sons of the prophets came to view at Jericho, saw him, they said, the spirit of Eliyahu doth rest on Elisha. Elisha did not flinch at what seemed by human sight overwhelming odds. I think his eyes were always open to the spirits around him, and he knew that those who were arrayed for him were greater, both in number and in power, than those arrayed against him. It would be wonderful if we puny humans could get a grasp of this fact. It is an absolute fact. No matter what our adversary sends against us, we always have a larger and more powerful force supporting us. That's just the background for the first three verses. So you want to go ahead and take me apart? Go ahead.
Well, okay. No, I would probably go in a slightly different direction, actually, because what out of the first couple of verses, essentially what we seem to get is, we're gonna see this fleshed out, I guess, in the next couple of verses. It's going to seem that Eliyahu is going to take this threat from Jezebel to heart, for whatever reason, and there's lots of discussion. I'm sure we'll have it here as well about whether he, suffers from fear or what it is that gets to the guy. But he seems to go off and do something that would be out of character for the prophet that we've seen up until this point. Let me just leave it at that. Exactly. We'll go to Rob, and when we get the next couple of verses, we'll flesh some of that out. Rob, go ahead.
Okay. It says Ahab told Jezebel everything Eliyahu had done and how he had put all the prophets to the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to say to Eliyahu, may the gods do terrible things to me and worse ones besides if by this time tomorrow I haven't taken your life just as you took theirs. On right. Seeing that, he got up and fled for his life.
So something there scared him.
Yeah. In 1165, an agonizing question confronted the Moroccan Jewry. A fanatical Muslim sect called the Almohads had seized power and were embarked on a policy of forced conversion to Islam. The Jewish community was faced with a choice: to affirm the Islamic faith or die. Some chose martyrdom, others chose exile, but some acceded to terror and embraced another faith. Inwardly, though, they remained Jews and practiced Judaism in secret, and they were called conversos, or in Spanish, Moranos, pigs. How were they to be viewed by the Torah was the question. The name of the first rabbi is lost to us in history, but his view was emphatic, and I quote, "A Jew who had embraced Islam had forfeited membership in the Jewish community. He was no longer part of the house of Israel. For such a person to fulfill the commandments was meaningless. Worse, it was a sin. The choice was stark and absolute: to be or not to be a Jew. If you chose to be a Jew, you should be prepared to suffer death rather than compromise. If you chose not to be a Jew, then you must not seek to re-enter the house you had deserted." End of quote. Now, when we use the term Jew here, he's actually talking about a covenant-keeping Jew. Now, however, there was another opinion, and it was the opinion of Rambam, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, the greatest rabbi of the Middle Ages. Maimonides was no stranger to religious persecution. He was born in Cordova in 1135. He had been forced to leave along with his family some 13 years later when the city fell to the Almohads. 12 years were spent in wandering. In 1160, a temporary liberalization of the Almohad rule allowed the family to settle in Egypt. So within 5 years, he was forced to move again, settling in the land of Israel and ultimately coming back to Egypt. Maimonides was so incensed by the rabbi's reply to the forced convert that he wrote his own response, and it's called the Igaret HaShamad, the Epistle to the Forced Conversion. In it, he frankly disassociates himself from the earlier ruling and castigates its author, whom he describes as a self-styled stage who has never experienced what so many Jewish communities had to endure in the way of persecution. "If you're faced with religious persecution," says Maimonides, "you must leave and settle elsewhere. If he is compelled to violate even one precept, it's forbidden to stay there. He must leave everything he has and travel day and night until he finds a spot where he can practice his religion. This is preferable to martyrdom." In the course of his analysis, Maimonides turns to the prophet Elijah. Jezebel issued a warrant for his death, and Elijah goes to Mount Horeb, where the Torah was established in the hearts of Israel. So we see something here. I don't think we see fear as so many Christian preachers like to point to, where Elijah, who had been so brave up until this time, and now he's tucking tail and running. I don't think so. It's not in his character. He would have wanted to go headlong in to Isabel and make a showdown with her.
All right. Well, hold on right there,
but
Rob. Let's pause at that point. Because I tend to agree with you about the fear thing. In years past, I might have said, no, it certainly looks like he's afraid. But I think in order to get there, what we need to do is read the next few verses and flesh all of this out. Because verse 3 does say that he, and this is presumably Eliyahu, saw, and he got up, and he went to save his life. He came to Beersheba, which belonged to Judah. In other words, he left the northern kingdom, went south. He left his servant there. And then he went alone into the desert there, one day's journey, and came and sat under a single juniper and asked for his soul that he might die, his nefesh that he might die, saying, "It's enough. Now, O Elohim, take my soul, for I am no better than my father's." And here there is, as we've kind of already laid out among just the three of us, no shortage of commentary and midrash and disagreement about what's really going on with Eliyahu. You know, he's obviously, or at least this is what we're told, he's obviously afraid of Jezebel. She might do this. And let me lay out a couple of things. There is no shortage of textual analysis and the way that the various Hebrew words can be explained here. Let's see, al nefshu can be interpreted in more than two ways: for the sake of his soul, or to save his life, or maybe he's now on his own. And that's kind of an interesting take, that he's proceeding without divine guidance. So what was it that, at least on its surface, caused a great prophet and such of a pious man to become afraid? Now, what I thought was kind of interesting, I'll throw this out, we'll go to you, Rob, was that up until this point, now this makes sense to me, maybe you guys disagree, but anyway, up until this point, Eliyahu has been on a mission from God, if you will. He knows what he's got to do. He's going to do it. He can march into the king's chamber, oh, troubler of Israel, and not worry about the fact that Eliyahu isn't going to be able to suffer at the king's hand, because he has the Creator on his side and his job isn't done. But now, it is. So the argument goes something like, okay, up until this point, he had the protection of a mission, if you will, and now he doesn't. He is suddenly realizing that his job as a messenger has been fulfilled. His occupation for the last 3 years is complete, and he no longer, at least quite, has the same sense of being protected come, if you will, hell or high water here. And then there's this too. The sages point out, you know what? He still has more reason to fear Jezebel than Ahab, because as gnarly as this son of a gun is, at least you could argue that he understood the Creator of the universe and was obedient to the God of the Bible. Whereas with Jezebel, the exact opposite is true. So she, unlike him, wouldn't hesitate if she could kill the guy to go ahead and do it. All right, go ahead, Rob.
Well, I think there's several things here. There's the destination. Where does he go? He goes to Mount Horeb. So there's a purpose in where he's going. He's going back to the foundation of faith. He's going back to where it all started. And he's seeking Yahweh. Now, and so he wants to know, what am I supposed to do now? And certainly, he is saving his life. Sure, I make no qualms with that. But why? Now, Maimonides is saying that he's leaving Israel because it violates Torah to stay. Isabel has made a death warrant out for him. Remember, this is what's kept the prophets of Yahweh quiet at the table of Jezebel, is that she'll kill them if they speak up. And Elijah has not only spoken up, but he's led a demonstration, a Tiananmen Square, if you will, against the government, not just against the religion, but against the government of Israel. And so she's put a death warrant out for him. So not only will she kill him, but there are bounties looking for him so that they can turn him over. So he's got to leave Israel because he cannot any longer practice his faith. And this is what Maimonides was saying, is that if you live in a country that outlaws the faith of Yahweh, you're commanded to leave and to seek the face of Yahweh for a place to settle. And he certainly lived that. And he points to Elijah's precedent here, that he fled and he sought the face of Yahweh to where he was supposed to go. And that, I think that's what we see here. We see he goes, if you will, to the command center, and he asks the commander, okay, now what? What's the mission now? You know, what's the rules of engagement now? Now there's a bounty for my head. Okay, So what are the rules of engagement? I need to know. And I think that's what we see here. This is a soldier of the Torah, a brave soldier. Not only that, but he is a ranger, if you will. And he's part of the special forces. And so he's not a coward. He's already been proven in battle. And why would he turn tail and run now? That's my point. It goes against his character up until this point. It doesn't fit.
Okay, MP, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, a little bit. remember that in verse 1, Eliyahu ran about 20 miles to beat Achav to Yezreel. Okay? Zamra says that Eliyahu fled just as Yaakov had fled from Esav and Moshe from Paro. Eliyahu had tried to use drought and famine, followed by a miracle on Mount Carmel to bring Israel to repent, but now he was overwhelmed with the terrible sense of failure, and he wanted to resign from his ministry to leave it to Elohim to redeem his people. Eliyahu went out into the wilderness without any food or water, and crouching under a solitary broom tree, KJV says it's a juniper, that afforded scarcely any shade, he begged Elohim to take his life. Now, that's the end of the Zamra quote. Now, juniper is translated from H7574 Rotem, from the Hebrew root 7573 Ratam, which means to tie or to bind up. Now, I think that from this point, his spirit will be bound to Yehovah's in the same way that Moshe's and Yaakov's were, because he is about to spend 40 days and nights in his presence on the north slope of Horeb. In my opinion, it was on the north slope, outside of time and space. He did not eat another thing until that time is over. So he's in absolute communion with Yehovah for the next 40 days. Okay? That's where we're at. Now, I think Yehovah is further empowering Eliyahu with his, that is Yehovah's Ruach, in preparation to deliver a double portion of it to Eliyahu early in 2 Kings, which is only a couple of chapters away. Now, I think Elisha will be so in tune with the Ruach HaKodesh that he will always be able to perceive, as if by 20/20 vision, the spirits around him, 2 Kings 6-7 that we read earlier, and that without fear, knowing that the Ruach was on him. Now remember, in verse 1, Eliyahu ran about 20 miles to beat Achav to Yezreel. In verse 4, Eliyahu went even further in his run away from Jezebel. He left the land of promise. He exiled himself a day's journey into the wilderness and asked Yehovah to take his life. Yehovah is, in his chokmah, his wisdom, answered him by an angel in verse 5, who made a cake for him in verse 6. Not a birthday cake, but an unleavened cake. It may have been matzah time. And a cruise of H2O, which Eliyahu had partaken of, he fell right back to sleep. Okay, so Eliyahu is in a transition here. And we're going to see that the transition is going to be, you're going to anoint a couple of kings. You're going to anoint the prophet Elisha in your place, and you're going to come home to me. Now, it's going to take 3 or 4 years for that to happen, but all that stuff is going to happen to him in the not too distant future. And, that's what I got up to verse 6. And I'm going to stop.
Okay. Let me make just a quick one on this, because you're leaping ahead to Elisha, Elisha. And it's not clear to me that that's a good leap to make yet. So we'll pick up there after the top of the hour. We're there. Take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around.
Sometimes I lay under the moon.
welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. All right, we are back, folks. Second hour now of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh edition. When we went to the break just briefly, and I didn't quite have time to get it all out, MP had made a statement about Eliyahu that I wasn't quite sure I agreed with, and I wanted to make sure I at least briefly mentioned that. And it had to do with the whole situation with what happens with Elisha, and how did he get there. We haven't read it yet. We'll get to the story, but I kind of tend to think that one of the things that we're going to see in the cave here is going to help to cement the idea that it's time for Eliyahu to retire. I could be wrong on that score, as Mark likes to point out, too. But in any case, that's kind of the place where I'd say, oh, let's just see how the story develops, and we'll see what was going on with all of the ins and outs here of Eliyahu, rather, running away and heading south into the mountains. All right. Mark, any other comments? We'll go to Rob, and we'll read a bit
no,
more.
Go right to Rob. That'll be fine.
Okay.
Well, I don't understand the view that he was a failure in his ministry. I think he was very successful.
I don't think any of us have said that, Rob.
Well, yeah, that was clearly said. He said that his ministry up until the time was a failure, and so he ran away in fear. Well, that's not at all what happened.
Well, no, I don't think any of us said that. His ministry was complete. He had a mission, is what I said anyway.
No. I know what you said. I'm talking about Mark Patron.
Okay.
In his notes, he clearly said that Elijah's ministry was a failure, or he felt like a failure.
He felt like a failure. Yes.
But that's not the case. He didn't feel like a failure.
I think he did.
He'd won.
We can disagree on that.
He won. How did he feel like a failure? He won. And not only that, as he has a bounty on his head now, so now he has a prize, a scar, if you will, a warrior.
A red badge of courage. Yeah.
A red badge of courage, exactly. So there's no feeling of failure. Now he needs to go find out what his mission is. He's accomplished the first phase of his mission. Now what? And so he goes underneath the tree and says, okay, take my life now. I'm successful. I've done what I was supposed to do. No reason for me to live. And Yahweh sends a messenger. Now that's interesting. Why? He could have gotten an audible voice. He certainly had received miraculous messages before. So why did he need a messenger? Because he needed refreshment, like Yeshua in Gethsemane. He needed refreshment. So Elijah went in the strength of that refreshment that the messenger gave him, his unleavened cake and his jug of heavenly water. So he went in the strength of that refreshment that he received from the angel of Yahweh, a 40 days journey to Horeb. He was now on holy ground, and it was the mountain of Yahweh on which Moses had seen the angel of Yahweh in the bush and was within sight of Sinai, memorable for the giving of the Torah. On Horeb, he lodges in the same cave, the very recess from which Moses witnessed the Shekhinah in Exodus 32:22. And here becomes he's subject to a divine communication and revelation.
Okay.
At Mount Horeb, he receives this strange vision. He witnesses a whirlwind, a tornado, then an earthquake, then a fire. But he is led to understand that Yahweh is not in these things. He's above them. And so I think this is setting up a showdown in the heart of Elijah. He's getting clarity on who and what Yahweh is. The fire fell from heaven, but Yahweh wasn't the fire.
Okay, well, hang on. We'll get there, Rob. Just a second.
I'm pointing back to Mount Horeb. Mount Carmel. The fire fell from heaven, but Yahweh wasn't in the fire. I mean, Yahweh wasn't the fire. You understand? That was his judgment, but he wasn't his judgment. People get confused with this. They see the judgment of Yahweh and they think that's Yahweh. That's not Yahweh.
So okay.
I think it's very important for us to understand what Yahweh is, and that's what Elijah is going to receive. Clarity on what Yahweh is.
All right. Well, we'll get there in just a second too. The one thing I would point out, you mentioned, and I've certainly seen it in the Midrash, that he goes to Horeb. That part is clear, but that it's the same cave that Moshe was in when he was hidden in the rock. Yeah, I know that is the Midrashic statement, but I don't know that it's provable from Scripture, right? Can you correct me on that?
I agree with you on that. It is Midrashic, but that doesn't mean that it's not true either.
No, I understand.
Well, right.
Okay. He goes to Horeb. We know that's true. That is Sinai. Horeb is Sinai.
Correct.
He goes into a cleft of the rock. Same word, cleft of the rock, cave, same word.
Okay. So far, so good.
Okay. And so, why would Elijah go there if he's not seeking the same place?
Oh, I don't doubt that he's looking for it and that he's heading back to that area. The only question is, and I don't even necessarily doubt that it might be right, as Mark was pointing out. Just that it's my natural bent to be careful and say, unless we can say for sure that it says that, it's an assumption that in fact that's the same cave.
It's an assumption, an educated assumption, if you will.
I'll buy that even. But, we'll go that far. Yep.
But the sages, their weight, and see, I have no problem siding with the sages. I think that they're mostly right.
I don't even disagree with that. The only problem I have is saying that it's an absolute thing as opposed to it's a likely thing. And in this case, yeah, it probably is a very likely thing.
And not only this, but it seems to be where every prophet that needs clarity goes. Shaul went there. Paul went there.
Right.
Yeshua goes into the same wilderness.
Sinai and Arabia.
And so we see this precedent being set by Elijah. And so why do these men do that? They do that because it goes, it's a teshuva, if you will, back to the original revelation, the theophany of Moses. When he entertains the presence of Yahweh in a concentrated way.
Okay. Again, so, no argument on any of those scores, and maybe that's enough said. I just wanted to make sure we point out that when I see a statement in the Midrash that says he was at this place, or he said this, or you know this was the same as that, I want to know, okay, can we see that from Scripture, or is it just an educated guess? And I have no problem with the speculation, but in this case it is an educated guess.
Well, and it's interesting because there in that cleft of the rock,
yeah.
What does Yahweh say? Yahweh seems to allude to the fact, what are you doing here? Why are you here at this place?
Right.
This wasn't for you. This was for Moses. What are you doing here? This is where I met Moses. What are you doing here? That's what appears to be saying here in his, there's a familiarity in what Yahweh is saying. What are you doing here? He didn't say, why are you out here in the wilderness? you know, why'd you come to the desert? He said, why did you come here? At
all
the
right.
point that there is a specific special thing about here, if you will. So
okay.
I think there's enough in the scripture that would allow an agreement with the sages.
Well, let me do this, Rob. We didn't actually read the in-between places. Let's set up at least a little bit of the evidence in that direction, okay? Again, I don't have a problem with the leap. It's the fact that it is a leap as opposed to, you know, a certain thing. Yeah. But there are some indications in here which we didn't touch on yet. So we've got Eliyahu in
verse 10 at least.
Yeah, let's go Mark. Let's do 5 and 6.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's all a leap.
Well, sure.
It's all
sure.
a leap, dude.
Okay. Well, so okay, let's go through it briefly, though. He goes to sleep under. He goes to sleep under a juniper. He gets this. He gets the malak, the messenger, telling him go and eat. And there is a cake baked on coals, which is an interesting Hebrew turn of phrase. And that is, as the sages say, here we go. This doesn't seem like as much of a leap. It just appears out of nowhere. This is a divine little bit of food that he's given.
Yeah.
And again.
By the way, that cooking on coals, I've actually experienced. That's the way you make unleavened bread. Is you have these big stones that you make the cake and you slap it on those stones and they cook quite quickly on those hot stones.
Right,
which is amazing. Anyway,
that are laid in the coals, correct?
Yeah, they're laid in the coals. Yeah.
And there's one more reference here that is worth noting, and that is that Isaiah, if you remember, Yeshayahu, when he says, take a coal from the altar, touch it to my lips, and that's going to purify your lips, that is the same wording that's used there. Okay, so verse 7 then says, the malak of Elohim came back again, touched him, and said, get up and eat. You got a long ways to go. And there are different ways that could be... could be rendered too in the English,
right.
And one of those is the way that you have chosen is long, or literally it could mean that it's a way that is from you. In other words, it's not a way I've chosen; it's a way you have chosen. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, it's interesting because the angel is alluding to the fact that he has a destination, that there's a point to his going. He's going somewhere specifically. He's not just wandering around. That then you have no idea how long the journey is. You're just wandering. But in this case, he's got a specific place he's going. And so the angel is saying, you got a long ways to go.
Okay. And then he eats and he drinks. And he went by the strength of that, says verse 8. So this is right there in genuine print. By the strength of that, he went 40 days and 40 nights unto the mountain of Elohim, Horeb. Now, here probably, Rob, is the strongest evidence that we could cite to support the claim that you were making, the little bit of a leap there. And at least if you look at it this way, the reference doesn't make it quite as much of a leap. So with this in play, I don't have as much of a problem as, you know, as it might sound like. Again, I just want to make sure we understand this is dot connection as opposed to thus spoke Yahuwah.
Well, that's why my point is the angel is saying you have a destination that you're going to. We find out what these two knew. They seem to know something we don't know, the angel and Elijah, where he's going. And so he arrives at Horeb, the mountain of Elohim. That has always been understood to be the mountain of Elohim. And so he's going there specifically, and then as we see, he goes into a cave, and he spends the night there. Now, if you've ever been there, there's only one cave.
Okay. Well, I mean that's an excellent point. So
I've been there.
It's
and
almost
there's only one cave.
Okay. There we go. And there's another claim in the Midrash. I'll throw this out that it's just the right size, kind of like the Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Not too big, not too small, just right size for him to fit in there too, as Moshe did,
sure.
making him think he belonged there.
And it is a small cave, and I think that's why it's called a cleft, not a cavern. It's not a cavern. It's just a small recess, but it's there. and it's defined. And so you can see how Moses or Elijah crawled up into it. And I think Shaul did later, and when he was trying to get clarity himself. So, and it says that when he got into the cave, the word of Yahweh came to him. And it said to him, "What are you doing here?"
Okay.
"What are you doing here, Eliyahu?"
Yep. And that's exactly what it says. And then we're going to hear his response. Now, this takes us to the place where I was essentially disagreeing a bit with MP at the top of the hour, having to do with, is Elijah, Eliyahu, acting a bit presumptuously, in all of this? And certainly there are indications. Now, the other thing that I guess I'll point out that the Midrash, some of them anyway, make the claim is, maybe Elijah's suffering from a bit of crisis of confidence here. Like, he doesn't think he's hearing as clearly, and he needs to go, down here south, to get this, re-up, if you will, or something. So, what's always bugged me about this whole passage is we don't see the same level of confidence in this guy that was literally willing to put his life on the line, stand there in front of those priests of Baal and say, "Come on," you know, get sarcastic with them even, up the ante, and I know what's going to happen here. I got no doubt about it. And at this point, he does seem to have some doubt about it.
I think he's not so much that he has a doubt about it. He needs clarity for mission.
Especially
Mark's a military man. He knows how insecure a warrior gets when the rules of engagement are not clear and when the mission and objective is not clear. It is insecure, and so you need to go to the commander and find out what are the rules of engagement, what is the mission. I don't understand.
Yep.
He's willing to fight. He just needs to know. What is he doing?
Okay, yeah. I'm hanging out here. What's going on? Okay, well, so let's go ahead and read the speech unless we got more comments on the lead up to it, cuz I think that'll help to clarify what's going on.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking about where are you at? Verse 9?
That's no, 9 and 10. Yeah, 9 and 10. Yeah.
Okay, if you go ahead and read those, and then let me have it for a few minutes, and you guys can shoot me down some more.
So he did.
Let me read it from a Hebraic standpoint. I think it will be clearer. And he said, "I've been very zealous for Yahweh Elohai Zevaot." That's interesting, what he calls him. He doesn't call him just Yahweh.
Right.
He calls him Yahweh Elohai or Elohi Zevaot.
Right.
The Yahweh of armies. "Because the people of Israel have abandoned your covenant, broken down your altars, and killed your prophets with a sword. Now I'm the only one left. And they're coming after me to kill me too." And he said, "Go outside and stand on the mountain before Yahweh." And right then and there, Yahweh went past. Just like with Moses.
Right.
I think this is awesome, because just like with Moses, he sees the hinder part of Yahweh. Well, he sees Yahweh pass. It sounds like it's fleeting, that he just caught a glimpse of it. "And a mighty blast of wind tore the mountain apart and broke the rocks into pieces before Yahweh, but Yahweh was not in the wind." After the wind came an earthquake, but Yahweh was not in the earthquake. After earthquake, fire broke out, but Yahweh wasn't in the fire. And after the fire came a quiet, subdued voice. When Eliyahu heard it, he covered his face with his tallit, with his cloak. And he stepped out, and he stood at the entrance of the cave. And then the voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Eliyahu?" And he answered,
Let's pause right there. There's a whole lot of meat in there and lots to talk about.
Sure.
Probably some things that we'll want to kick around and have some disagreements on. We promised MP we'd go to him. I do want to mention one thing, and that is that is everything that he has said up until this point true? Okay, and ultimately, I would say up until this point, this is part of the exposition of all this. Up until this point, what Elijah has said is true as far as what he's telling the Creator.
Right, or at least what he's perceived to be true.
Well, later on we're going to get to some places where he perceives something that ain't quite so much on point. So that's exactly why I want to make the distinction.
But you generally don't lie.
No, he's not lying. He's not lying. I don't think that.
I know. I'm just saying you don't lie to your Creator because you know the Creator knows everything.
But sometimes
so there's no reason to lie to him.
Sometimes
so he's not lying. So if it's not true, it certainly is perception.
Exactly. That's right, and that's why I was making the big stink about not leaping to things that aren't specifically clear in Scripture, because here's Elijah, perhaps, and we'll get there, making an assumption as opposed to something that he absolutely knows to be true. And that's key. Okay, MP, go ahead.
Okay, so in verses 6 through 10 or so, Eliyahu was obviously physically exhausted. Is that a possible reason for his dip into what I call sight walking? He saw what was going on and he ran away. Okay. Now I'd like to hope so, but does that mean that we might also be susceptible to the same thing? You and I. Okay. The time may come when we will be in a similar situation. If we are in of those in the time of Jacob's trouble, which is looking to be nearer and nearer with each passing day, we will need the same kind of nourishment to withstand the day. Okay? The angel in verse 7 tells Eliyahu that he is exhausted. The journey is too great for you. So Eliyahu, verse 8, did eat and drink and was nourished so that he could withstand the trip all the way to Horeb, to the mountain of Elohim, whence came the covenant to Israel from Jehovah. Azamra says this. They said, God miraculously provided Eliyahu with sufficient refreshment to sustain him for 40 days and nights, parallel to the 40 days and nights that Moshe did not eat when he ascended to heaven to receive the Torah. I don't think he went to heaven. I think he went up onto Horeb on the north side of the mount. But anyway, and Eliyahu retraced the steps of the master of the prophets in reaching the mountain of God in Horeb, i.e. Mount Sinai, where Eliyahu entered into the same cleft in the rock from which Moshe had seen Elohim's glory in Exodus 33:22. And that's important that we see that. I mean, when he was up there getting the covenant from Jehovah before the golden calf incident, that was when he saw the backside of Jehovah. Okay, so when he got to Sinai, Eliyahu found a cave for shelter. Whether it was the same cleft in the rock is not clear, but it could be, and set up a camp. And what to his wondering eyes did appear, but the word of Jehovah. Now I think the resurrected Mashiach Yeshua, who asked, in a Mark paraphrase, why are you here, Eliyahu? That's who I think it was. Don't you have a mission to accomplish? And Eliyahu answered with a Markism in verse 10. He says, I have done everything Jehovah Eloha Tzevaot asked me to do. Your people know it, but they want to kill me. And that will do you no good, because I'm the only guy left in Israel that gives a rip about you, your land, or your people.
Okay,
if Jezebel succeeds in killing me, you and Israel will be witnesses.
You went and done it. You leaped on past where we were at, MP.
That's but, verse 10.
Here we got a difference between the Hebrew and the English versions. I think that's part of the problem. Because you went past the place that Rob read about the he's not in the wind, he's not in the earthquake,
no,
he's not
in
the fire.
I didn't go anywhere near there. I didn't go anywhere near there. That comes in the next section here. Anyway.
I alone remained as close as we got to what it was you were paraphrasing, and they sought my soul to take it. So that's at least part of the place where
verse 10, right.
Yeah.
And we're coming up on the break.
Okay. Yes, we are. So we'll, and part of the reason why we're being so picky about this, I want to make sure we emphasize that, is because this is one of the prophets, the Tute prophets, that seems to be basically screwing up a bit. And we'll pick up there when we come back.
comma, dum, dooby, doo, dum, dum. Comma, comma, dum, dooby, doo, dum, dum. Keeping Torah's a joy. Yeshua, double me and you. I keep the peace and Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new.
All right, we are back, folks, and this is one of those places where, yeah, I think it's important we go slow and watch this simply because we're going to see Elijah. I almost want to use the term stepping in it a little bit here. Your prophets they've killed by the sword. I alone remained, and they seek my soul or sought my soul to take it. So the Midrash wants to go in a lot of directions about how, you know, how dare you stand in the place where Moshe was and so forth. I'm not sure if that's necessarily the main issue here. Maybe it is. It's always, I think, bothered me a little bit, and we'll get there. I didn't want Mark to leap there too quickly either, that Elijah is essentially going over the place where he can demonstrate what he needs to be talking about. In other words, I alone remain, and he is going to be shown to be wrong here in a minute. So we'll get there slowly. Rob, right, let's go to you.
But that's how he perceived it, that he alone remained.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, and what happened to Obadiah, for one?
It's all a matter of, well, I get it, but it's all a matter of perception.
Yep. And his, this, on the other hand, see, this is the guy whose perception matters because he is a prophet of the Creator. And that's,
correct,
that's the key. So is he or is he not, out on a limb here?
See.
Okay. Rob, any additional comments before we?
Sure. Sure.
I knew that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And understand, the prophets of Yahweh aren't saying anything.
Well, they're just guys.
No. What I'm saying is they're not saying anything because they know it will cause them to lose their life. The prophets of Yahweh are quiet. They're not saying a thing. Only Elijah is speaking up, and now he's got a bounty. So that's something that's got to be clear. Elijah's saying, nobody's saying anything but me. And so, you know, there in the cleft of the rock, right then and there, Yahweh went past. Just like when Moses saw the hinder parts of Elohim, Yahweh said to Moshe, I will also do what you have asked me to do because you have found favor in my sight and you know my name. But Moshe said, I beg you to show me your glory. And he replied, I will cause my goodness to pass before you, and in your presence I will pronounce the name of Yahweh. Moreover, I will show favor to whomever I will and display mercy to whomever I will. So this is the precedent that Elijah's coming on. I will show favor to whom I will and display mercy to whom I will. The question came to him by the word of Yahweh, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? In answer to this, he urged what Rabbi Shaul calls his intercession against Israel. In turbulent times, there's an almost overwhelming temptation for religious leaders to be confrontational. In the Midrash, this speech of Eliyahu is actually a dialogue, and it goes something like this. The Israelites have broken Yahweh's covenant, and Yahweh says, is it your covenant? And Elijah says, they've torn down your altars. And Yahweh says, but are they your altars? And Eliyahu says, they've put your prophets to the sword. And Yahweh says, but you're still alive. And Eliyahu says, and I am alone left. And Yahweh says, well, instead of hurling accusations against Israel, shouldn't you be pleading their cause? So the meaning of the Midrash is clear. The zealot takes the part of Yahweh, but Yahweh expects his prophets to be defenders, not accusers. The prophet hears not one imperative, but two, guidance and compassion, a love of truth and a love for the people. And this is what he made real to Moses. And it changed Moses' whole outlook. And I think that's what he's doing with Elijah. You know, in Romans 11, 2 through 8, it says, Yahweh has not repudiated his people, quoting 1 Samuel 12, 22 and Psalms 94, 14, whom he chose in advance. I chose them before they were good. Or don't you know what the Tanakh says about Eliyahu? He pleads with Yahweh against Israel. Yahweh, they have killed your prophets and tore down your altars, and I'm the only one left, and now they want to kill me too. Quoting this passage. But what is Yahweh's answer to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not knelt down to Baal.
Right, and we're getting there. That's the secret.
That's the same way in this present age. There is a remnant chosen by grace, Shaul says. Now that's in Romans 11, 2 through 8. So the motive of this intercession to Yahweh against Israel is not personal revenge, but zeal for Yahweh. Of what use then could he be to such a people? The reputation of the answer when a second time the question shows the deep sincerity of the prophet's soul. To receive the answer and the witness, the vision he has caused to stand on the mountain before Yahweh, on the very place where Moses stood on a similar occasion. Terrible signs immediately followed upon the passing of Yahweh. And I would say that when Yahweh enters creation, even just his glory, climatic occurrences happen in the natural. It can't help it. He is that powerful. First, a great strong wind rent the mountain and broke in pieces the rocks before Yahweh. There was a sign of wrath upon the rulers and the people through this invasion. You can compare that with Ezekiel 6:2 and Amos 4:1. And after the wind and earthquake, this is the sign of revolution, whether in things civil, ecclesiastical, or both. You can see that in Psalm 68:11 and Revelation 6:12 and Revelation 16:18. And after that, the earthquake, a fire. And this is the symbol of judgment more immediate from Yahweh. We see that in Deuteronomy 4:24 and Psalms 18:12 through 14, so on and so forth. He is a consuming fire. But Yahweh was in none of these. Judgments are necessary to the order of his government, but nonetheless, these are Yahweh's judgments. He delights in mercy, says Micah 7:18. So Yahweh was in the still small voice which followed. So Elijah wrapped his face in his tallit and he listened. You can compare that with Isaiah 6:2. So this is an amazing turn of events. And we're going to see actually these three things played out in people. And I'll show you that in just a few minutes. But it's amazing.
Okay. Well, so let's lay out a couple of things that are, I guess you'd say, on the table at this point. One of the things that I have suggested in the past, and I think you make a good point, Rob, there's more to this, and that's the real key. Because there does seem to be this rebuke going on. The creator of the universe gives Elijah a couple of chances to kind of figure out exactly what's going on here. Finally, he gets this demonstration. The mighty wind, the earthquake, the fire, and then the still small voice. Are you listening yet? Are you getting it? And he's basically, when he's asked the second time, what are you doing here? Well, I have acted zealously for Yahuwah El Zevuot, and the children of Israel abandoned your covenant. So Rob's point is that he is being rebuked because he doesn't intercede, perhaps, for the people of Israel. I guess I would add to that another element, there does seem to be a little bit of self-pity in here. I don't necessarily like that terminology, especially with this guy, so I'm reluctant to use it. But certainly, the whole concept that I alone am left, and they're looking to kill me too, and if they kill me, hey, it's over, dude. You know, I'm the only one left here. Oh, wait a minute. That is a bit presumptuous. So he gives him a second chance, and he still essentially doesn't quite get it. Now, eventually he does, but not before the die seems to be cast, and we're going to see it in the next few verses. All right, time for you to retire, Eliyahu. You've done a great job, don't get me wrong, but go appoint a successor. All right, MP, you want to weigh in too? Mark?
Okay, there we go. There we
Yes, got to have a microphone.
Got to have the microphone on. Yeah, the he was given the argument to Jehovah, and he said, if Jezebel succeeds in killing me, you and Israel will be witnessless. Okay, and that of course is not true, but it is what he was perceiving at that time. Okay, I don't believe he was lying. I think that's what he actually thought.
No, I don't think any of us believe that he was lying or making any...
Exactly.
Yeah, we're not going there for sure.
Right, so Jehovah answered him cryptically, that particular speech. He said,
step outside. I have a few things to show you.
Okay. When Eliyahu obeyed and he stood out on the mount before Jehovah, Jehovah passed by. Now, that word translated passed by is the Hebrew 5674. The actual word in the Tanakh is avorar. I'm sorry, over, okay, from avar, which means to cross over to the other side or to move to a different condition. This is the exact word used with the same vowel pointing in chapter 18 and verse 29. When the noon offering time had passed and the prophets of Baal had still not gotten a response from their gods, and Eliyahu began repairing the altar on Carmel. Now, there may be a connection from there, but where Jehovah is using Eliyahu's past associated righteous actions to what he is about to do by way of awakening his spirit to reality, Jehovah's reality, not merely what Eliyahu can see with his physical eyes. The physical power Jehovah is about to show Eliyahu is as spiritually useless as was all the gyrations and bloodletting of the prophets of Baal. I think that Jehovah is trying to awaken Eliyahu to his need of repentance. It was when Jehovah avoared, okay, that his crossed over, that his ruach moved the wind to tear the mountain and break the rocks in itty-bitty pieces by its sheer physical power. But it wasn't his ruach that tore and broke. It was the natural force. And after the wind came an earthquake. But again, it was just a tectonic movement, not a manifestation of Jehovah's sovereign power. Then there came a fire in verse 12. But again, it wasn't any of the physically demanding and challenging things that always draw puny humans' attention, but a quiet, barely perceptible voice. Jehovah doesn't do ostentatious. That's for parlor tricks, like Penn and Teller do. It's not that he doesn't use the physical or the heathen to bring his judgment on the world or even on his own people. He does. But it won't convince anyone of who he is. He uses little, usually unpretentious things to get our attention, like the still, small voice. Okay, Azamra says this. Targum Yonasan explains that the great and mighty wind, the earthquake, the fire, were successive revelations of great camps of angels, the agents through whom Elohim controls the creation. Ruach and Esh are respectively the air and fire elements, while Ra'ash is not necessarily only an earthquake, but also alludes to the water element. Targum renders Ra'ash as Ziyah, to sweat, which also has a connotation of sweating. From the sweat of the Chayos comes the river Dinur. Okay? I'm not sure what the river Dinur is, but that's what he said.
We know about the river Nile. We got that one all over the place.
It's, denial is not a river in Egypt, correct. In a lesson to all spiritual seekers at all times, our text teaches that the true glory of God was not in these sensational pyrotechnics, but in the tranquil silence of the still small voice that came afterwards in verse 12. When we search for God, we must listen with the utmost attentiveness to the almost imperceptible voice of truth that speaks so softly deep down in the heart and the soul. That's the, was from Azamra. A very good source, by the way. Now, it was when Eliyahu heard that still small voice in verse 13 that he covered his face with his cloak and went to the mouth of the cave, and he heard the voice whisper to him. So why are you here?
You're running
it was
by
pretty
me here?
Obvious. He said, why are you here?
Yeah.
Okay. it's pretty obvious that Eliyahu wanted to be petulant. That's what covering his face with his cloak signified. And was not going to be anything else, because he said in Mark chapter 14, or verse 14 rather, in a Mark paraphrase, I have been zealous for you and your word, but all it's gotten me is the hatred and animosity of the people of Israel, to the point where I am the only Jehovah-fearer left. Okay, that's twice he said that now. He was not going to do the great things that he had done before. He went from one side of the spiritual cycle to the other in less than a minute and was not going to return. So Jehovah let him have his way. Eliyahu still had to anoint his successor, who would be the Elisha that we spoke of earlier, and Eliyahu would walk the earth for a time yet, but no great miracles occur to his action, though he still is the head of the prophets. He didn't get demoted. He was not demoted. He was not diminished in the eyes of his Talmudim, but he had been used as much as he would allow. Okay? That's the way I see it, and I'm going to have arguments there, but go ahead. Go ahead and lay it on me.
Okay, Rob, you got any laying
That's
on
what
to do?
14.
Well, you know, Elijah wrapping himself, his face in his tallit, is a sign of reverence, much like Moses had when Yahweh came to him at the same place. These three things that he experiences, the strong wind, the tornado, if you will, the earthquake, the fire, as we'll see in 1 Kings 19, 15 through 18, Yahweh said to him, go back by way of the Damasek desert. When you get there, anoint Hazael to be king over Aram. Also anoint Jehu ben Nimshi to be king over Israel. And anoint Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel Makola, to be prophet after you. Jehu will kill whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will kill whoever escapes the sword of Jehu. Still, I will spare 7,000 in Israel, every knee that hasn't bent down before Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So, Eliyahu.
Just got a lesson, didn't he?
Yes, the intercessor against Israel, and therefore the impersonation of anger against sin, was to return to Israel by way of Damascus, where he was to anoint Hazael to be king over Aram or Syria. In Hazael, now we must look for the strong wind that was to come up and make havoc upon the mountains and rocks of Israel. Jehu ben Nimshi was Eliyahu to anoint king over Israel. Here was the instrument of the earthquake of revolution. Not only did Jehu bring a signal destruction upon the whole house of Ahab, but he brought down judgment also upon the worshippers of Baal. And Elisha ben Shaphat of Abel Nicola was this impersonation of righteous anger to anoint to be prophet in his room. Here is Yahweh's instrument of fire. His words are to be swords of flame. O Yehu will kill whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will kill whoever escapes the sword of Yehu. No sinner can escape the fire of Yahweh's word. But the still small voice triumphs. I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not knelt down to Baal. Yahweh is his faithful hidden ones, says Psalms 83:3. No wonder Eliyahu should cover his face with his tallit in reverent gratitude at the discovery of that sealed company in whose midst was Yahweh Shema. Yahweh has just revealed, not only has he got his marching orders, but he's prophesied the future for Elijah. He can see the completion of his mission. This is awesome.
Okay. And, well, I guess you'd say it's good news and bad news for Elijah at this point. And note that he's still got some good stuff ahead of him too. So
absolutely, he's not been demoted or anything. He's at the end of his, just about at the end of his ministry. He's got a few more things to do, and then he'll be done. Now it's going to take a couple of years to get it done, but that's the way it is.
Okay, so here's the question I'll ask. We've got less than a minute to go, because we're not quite at the end of the chapter. We're at the end of this part of the story anyway. Good news, bad news, we've talked about both of those. Was this a change of plans? In other words, when Elijah went into the cave, was this something, you know, we know that the creator of the universe already knew how it was going to come out. But had Elijah acted differently, you know, would there have been a different outcome or not?
I would say, yeah, there's a good, very good possibility that if he hadn't acted the way that he did, he would have gone on for a bit longer, in the power that he was showing, the power of Yehovah that he was showing through his works. But, you know, like I said, in my opinion, he descended into sight walking when he saw that he was the only one that would speak up. So that is where I'm standing, and I'll stand here for a while until somebody proves me absolutely wrong.
Okay. Absolutely wrong? You can't be just a little bit wrong?
No, gotta be absolutely wrong.
Okay. All right. Well, we are, Rob, any final comments on this one?
Well, I think it's clear that he was exactly where Yahweh had placed him to this point in time. And that he's got clarity of mission now, and not only that, but he can see a light at the end of the tunnel for Israel. Now, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
It still hasn't been fulfilled yet. Israel is still in darkness, still wandering around, still vacillating between Baal and Yahweh.
That's a good point.
And so our mission is a continuation of Elijah's, to go out and sift the house of Israel from the nations.
Amen.
And preach the unadulterated, the kingdom is nigh. And that's important, because the kingdom will swallow you up, or it will absorb you. It's all up to you. It's coming. It's a zeitgeist. It's coming whether you like it or not. And it will either run over you, or you'll get in it and go with it.
All right.
So it's
up
to you.
We're going to have to go with the flow and get ready for the music to come up, because that takes us to the end. So we'll pick it up in essentially the middle of the book, of 1 Kings chapter 19, when we get back. And the continuing story of Elijah, and of course, next week we'll continue the introduction to this fellow Elisha too. But that'll do it for now. Thanks, guys. Shalom, folks.